If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right, right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
I'm Greg Blaze, host of Cutting the Curd. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Listening to Eat Your Words on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Kathy Irway. It's a lovely fall day today in Brooklyn. We are 2 days away from the general election. Dun, dun, dun. So I think it's always great to look back at history as we may be entering a new era today in the next year with a new president. And you know, let's look at the policies that have worked over the years and maybe what didn't or what other unexpected consequences happen with regards to public policy. So I'm talking today with the authors who have written an incredible history. It is a culinary history of the Great Depression. It is called A Square Meal. The authors are local authors Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Coe. How are you?
Good.
Good. We're good.
Thanks so much for joining. So, Jane, your last book was the highly acclaimed 97 Orchard, an edible history of five immigrant families in one New York tenement. You also curate the Tenement Museum in New York City.
Well, I curate food-themed events there, yes, from on and off from time to time.
Excellent. And, Andrew, your James Beard nominated book was Chop Suey, A Cultural History of Chinese Food in the United States.
Yes.
That was a great book. And so you guys clearly are culinary historians. And would you call yourselves that? Or
yes.
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Good. Great.
Well, culinary historians, independent scholars, writers.
Husband and wife.
Yeah, husband and wife.
Also.
Eaters.
Brooklynites.
Brooklynites. So, you know, this book really cuts an incredible cross-section of interests that I think are really relevant today. So everything from social programs, like let's talk about food stamps or SNAP, right, to food justice issues, things like access to fresh food in impoverished neighborhoods, and the quest for nutritional perfection. So things like vitamin supplements and other kind of meal replacement liquids that we're seeing these days all tie into you know, the pivotal moment that you guys trace, which is the Great Depression and its impact on food. And I just have to ask, why did you decide to tackle this topic?
Well, we had both finished our books about around the same time, and we were looking for new topics. And we realized that the Great Depression was interesting for a number of reasons. And one of the reasons is that it marked a big change from the past, like the 19th century. We had this idea that America was like incredibly abundant, and that we were living in a kind of in the middle of a breadbasket, which could never, like, the food would never give out. As long as we kept traveling west, you know, into the toward the frontier, there would always be great soil and great land, and anybody could make a go of it.
And buffered by the fact that Europe was, you know, having all these famines and people were coming over to America to be fed by this
abundance.
We
had never known famine, and it's unlike any other country on Earth. And so, in the Great Depression, this is what changed. Mm-hmm. And as we got deeper into the story, we realized that not only that was one big change, but also kind of marked a pivot between a 19th century way of eating based on subsistence agriculture, locally produced food, to a 20th century modern way of eating, the way we eat today, which is everything is shipped in from out of state or around the world. And, you know, we have supermarkets and refrigerated foods and canned foods, et cetera, et cetera. So
That's
this
right.
is the time when that world really became possible.
That's right. Jane, did you want to add anything to that, or why did you any other take on why this
is
relevant?
Yes.
Or?
I mean, there's in addition to the material differences in the way we eat, we in the Great Depression began to think about food differently. Mm-hmm. And that was another really important shift. And I think one of the really fundamental differences is the importance of nutrition and how that became a kind of guiding principle directing us toward what foods we should and should not eat.
I thought it was really an amazing parallel that you write about how Eleanor Roosevelt, as the First Lady, really helped move this nutritional campaign in America, kind of like reorganizing nutritional standards, trying to attain for the best health of the country. And if you look at the parallels today, you see Michelle Obama with her, you know, Let's Move campaigns and really taking up
that
role.
In a way, Michelle Obama sort of took the cue from Eleanor Roosevelt, who even before the Depression was a proponent of what, you know, we know today as the home economics movement, which in fact was a progressive social reform movement, came out of the early 20th century and was in its way this a really sort of radical new way of thinking about women's work.
Efficiency.
Very much so.
And now we're saying, let's get back to the land, slow food. So that's interesting in its own.
But, yeah, no, in a way we're reacting against a lot of the sort of values that were held up as sort of the way that food should be during the Great Depression, the beginning. It was, you know, it was the beginning of food modernity, and we're trying to now reach back before
convenience
that,
and so forth. Well, I feel very enlightened having read your book, and I wanted to share a little bit, a little snippet, if I may, passage from the beginning. This hopefully explains what I was just saying about efficiency and the differences that you know that we see today in like I guess the food movement. But you write about a growing rift between country life and urban life, and how this tension really put in motion a lot of the changes that we saw during the Great Depression and afterwards. So, okay, I'll just start reading. In great urban centers, the pulse of the factory served as a kind of metronome for the city at large. In the urban workplaces, where wages were paid by the hour, efficiency was a measure of success. Factory hands demonstrated their worth by completing the maximum number of standardized motions in a given period. After the factory whistle blew, the time was on their own. But even at leisure, city dwellers saw time as a resource, like coal or copper. That fear that time might run out, as every resource will, left them with a dread of time wasted. On the farm, meanwhile, time was not something you stockpiled like firewood. Farm chores took as long as they took. There was no rushing an ear of corn, and the workday stretched to accommodate the tasks at hand. Time was elastic. The minutes and hours that mattered so much to city folk were irrelevant to the drawn-out biological processes on which the farmer depended. In place of the clock, the farmer's yardstick for measuring time was the progress of the seasons. As a result, his view of time was expansive, focused on the sweeping cycles of the natural world. For city people, time was fractured into finite segments like boxes on a conveyor belt. On the farm, time was continuous, like a string around a tree, one season flowing inevitably into the next. And so so post-World War I, a lot of people left the farm. A lot of people left the rural area, and that was seen as a big problem. And we see, of course, nowadays there's a fraction of people who are farmers. So this has been a growing, I guess, rural problem since this time. But I think that it's really interesting to look back at the different attitudes and how those social reform campaigns, the domestic campaigns that, you know, women of the day were trying to advocate for in the kitchen, as well as in, you know, on the farm, and how that impacted our way of looking at producing food. Mm-hmm. It's really...
Well, I mean, one of the things that was going on, it was, I mean, both, you know, it was... one of the things they wanted to do during this time was actually, these reformers actually wanted to free women from the kitchen.
Right.
Free women from, you know, the drudgery of kitchen tasks. From, you know, working from early in the morning to late at night to prepare food, to put food on the table, to make your own bread, to make your own biscuits, you know, to have to go to the garden to pick vegetables mm-hmm. and can them for the winter, et cetera, et cetera. And there was a huge campaign to change that and help women find a role for themselves in the larger community away from the home. Had to have jobs to do community service or something like that. Because the kitchen was seen as a kind of ball and chain on women's lives.
And at the same time, we saw an interest in nutritional science progressing. So the advent of sort of like the processed food processed food industry was happening at the same time. Nutritional supplements and things like flour and enriched, I guess you could say.
Well, that really comes toward the end of the Depression.
Okay.
As manufacturing becomes more modernized, and it's sort of the beginning of really mass food production and advances in technology that allows us to manipulate foods in all kinds of new ways. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of, it's in the years leading up to the Second World War is when you see all of those machinations take place.
I see. So Teddy Roosevelt and many other thinkers of the day, and I find it's really interesting that there was a whole rural sociology school of thought being formed, really were trying to combat the issue of the rural flight or the rural problem.
Yeah, or city drift.
Right. And how well did they not do in sort of addressing that?
Well, I don't think they did a very good job at all. I mean, they brought people's attention to the problem, mm-hmm. but they didn't reverse the problem. Because economically, the city was where everything was happening. So the city was where the action was. And the only thing that really reversed the rural flight, the flight of farmers into the city, was actually the onset of the Great Depression. Because as factories closed in the city, people who had, still had family out in the country returned to the country so they could, go back to farming and, grow their own food just out of desperation. But it really didn't do a very good job.
I see.
On the other hand, Andrew, this country life movement, which was this effort to sort of reform rural
and
culture
better with their life.
Mm-hmm. And in a sense impose sort of urban values on the American countryside, did have impact on the way people lived. And in a sense, the kind of the attempts to modernize the farmhouse, which were promised by the country life movement, were fulfilled during the Depression, during programs like the
Rural Electrification Administration, which brought electricity to people's farms all across the United States. And suddenly you could have refrigerators. Mm-hmm. And if you had refrigerators, that means you didn't have to can foods anymore. Mm-hmm. You could just keep the food in the freezer and you could go buy frozen foods, which were, the cutting edge at the time, very exciting. So it just it began to cut into people's connection to the farm. To the land, because suddenly you could be more part of like the larger culinary modern system.
And it's so interesting because you see these reforms happening with what seems like the best of intentions to help out, the rural communities and the farmers by modernization, mechanization, things like that. But do you think that this also propelled a sort of more a thirst for more and more output? I guess imposing the city values of, time is money and so forth. Do you think that forced bigger production?
Yeah, it did. I mean, in a lot of ways, and this is a complicated economic history, but the years before the Depression are sort of the last era of the independent farm.
Okay.
Yeah, the independent family farm, where a family sort of lives off the land and in a self-sustaining way that is a kind of American ideal that that you see that period is really gone. Closing. Yeah.
Until the, maybe the 70s back to Landers, perhaps.
Exactly.
But also, I mean, one thing that happened during the Great Depression is they wanted to modernize farm life. And that also meant, you know, new farm equipment and tractors and all kinds of mechanized, you know, machinery to make the food production more efficient. And that meant that you needed far less people on the farm. Mm-hmm. So it actually, impelled people to leave the farm because there were no longer jobs there. And so that's why you had people particularly leaving the South. I mean, like all the sharecroppers heading to Chicago or northern industrial cities or heading to California because there were no jobs left in the South because of mechanization.
Fascinating.
One of the really interesting things about this period and this attempt at rural reform is to look at the responses of the women who were the objects of this reform,
right. And
exactly, mm-hmm. And how there was significant pushback by rural women,
right.
Saying, "Who are these people who want us to become sort of efficient and who want us to function like workers on an assembly line? We really love our lives, and we have so much that you city people
don't understand.
Have." Yeah, so there was that we shouldn't think of these rural women as sort of passive recipients of the sort of reformers' advice. There was a lot of resistance put up by these ladies.
Wow. This history is so fascinating. I'd love to talk in the next, after a quick little commercial break, more about how, what we can take from these lessons in history. So we'll be right back after a quick little break.
And this one is called Relax, It's Just the End of the World by Techstar. We'll be right back. New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right. Right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
All right, we're back chatting more with Jane Siegelman and Andrew Coe, who have written A Square Meal, A Culinary History of the Great Depression. This is really, really a fascinating book, and I think it's a really timely book. So there's so much to talk about within it, but I don't want to forget the incredible research you've done about hunger and poverty throughout this investigation. So I thought it was really interesting, the differing attitudes about feeding the hungry throughout the years. So in one point, you write about how in the old world, in the British, in Britain, people thought of the worthy hungry and then the not worthy. So there's people who are like widows or elderly, disabled, they're worthy. And then there's people who are just sort of, I don't know, drunkards. Who are not worthy.
Just too darn lazy.
Too darn lazy.
That was the characterization of the poor.
And
they just didn't have the
right. Get
up and go to do what they needed to do.
And you see the parallels today, in talking about food assistance and or just social welfare in general.
Right. Well, if you don't work, it's a moral issue.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're able to work but don't actually like have a job or are not actively seeking work, then somehow you're immoral, and that makes you somebody who, if not, maybe won't be punished, but certainly somebody who won't be helped.
Mm-hmm. So during the Great Depression, everybody's hungry. Not everybody, but like a great deal of people now are suddenly hungry. Is that where we get a lot of the legacy for today's food assistance programs?
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay.
Before the Great Depression, up until Franklin Roosevelt became president, we essentially did not, the federal government certainly did not give any food assistance whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, we really didn't have any real consistent, coherent national nutrition program.
Mm.
This all changed during the Great Depression because millions of people were hungry. And some people were actually starving, and actually some people actually starved to death. And at the same time, people were voting, mm-hmm. and hunger became, and whether it's right to give people food or not was like a major issue in the 1932 election. And Hoover said, no, he's not going to feed the people unless it's really necessary.
Yeah.
And this was a time when there was 25% unemployment, the worst unemployment the United States had ever had. And there was lots of problems, and hungry people were roaming the street and scouring the garbage dumps. And so the question was, when will he really change his mind? And he never would.
Yeah.
And Roosevelt offered them hope.
Right.
And he offered them food. He said that he's going to make federal food relief will be one of the jobs of his administration. It changed the way Americans thought about food, and also changed their relationship to the federal government.
So in doing so, and I understand Herbert Hoover did this also in order to feed the soldiers during World War I, he sort of fixed prices against inflation for commodities in agriculture, right?
During World War I, yes.
Yes, and
yes.
Then didn't... Franklin Delano Roosevelt also sort of take that up in order to feed, or no?
No. Well, the problem with agricultural prices during the Great Depression is they were incredibly depressed.
Mm-hmm.
That there was incredible deflation, which meant that prices were dropping and farmers couldn't afford to bring their food to market because nobody had the money to buy it.
There was food. I mean,
right.
Which just goes to the point that there was food. It just wasn't getting to the hungry.
Okay.
So he was trying to prop up prices. And one of the ways he did it was actually instituted a huge food buying program by the federal government. They would buy it, and then it hand out that food as surplus food to relief clients.
I see. So I guess I was thinking that may sort of help explain some of the legacies that we have today in government assisting commodity crops and so forth.
Oh, yes, definitely, definitely.
Okay.
I mean, there's somewhere in the United States, I don't know exactly where, there's a mountain of cheese because the government is trying to prop up cheese prices and because cheese producers are making too much.
Right.
And this is a direct legacy of the Great Depression.
Now, do you think that it's not so necessary now that we're in the Great Depression? Is this something that we need to sort of look, take a second look at and say, why are we still doing this? Or do you think that, I mean, hey, we're in a pre-recession or post-recession, era now, or do you think
pre-recession too, probably.
Sorry. We're all, yeah. No, I mean, I don't know. It seems like these things were done at times of great need as like a dire.
Well, I mean, I think the reality is that there are always people in need.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly in a large and complicated economy like we have today, there always are groups of people who fall through the cracks, who aren't able to find jobs. There are industries which are firing people, and these people need help. The attitude is among some people who are against giving food relief is mm-hmm. that if you give these people the food, they won't be so active in looking for a job.
Mm-hmm. Essentially, we're still wrestling with the same ambivalence that we saw in the Depression about whether it's correct or not to give people a helping hand when they're down.
Right.
And there's this tremendous fear that by doing so, we'll crush something inside, some kind of that sort of
will.
American spark, that industriousness, that sort
of pull ourselves up by the bootstraps. You know, it's the frontier spirit. And of course, the question is, you know, how did that ever really exist? But also, there's some people, you know, some people have bad luck, and it means that not just those, you know, let's say a father loses his job. Are you going to punish the children as well?
So, I mean, it's a timeless subject then that, you know, people seem to be having current conversations about all the time. I think one of the things that's really fun reading this book is coming across all these tidbits about these moments in history. And you write about how the hobo, one of the stereotypical hobo foods was the mulligan stew. I've seen this at, like, fancy restaurants.
Really? Oh, my Lord.
I don't know. It's like a soup, right? Or no?
Well, it's like a watery stew made out of whatever cheap meat and vegetables you could beg, borrow, or steal.
Okay.
Or buy. But it's made from, like, a couple of old carrots, some really cheap beef, you know, gristly and a lot of bone. And some potatoes, and you just cook it and cook it until it's nice and thick and all the flavor is extracted from the ingredients. It's nothing special.
It's nothing special.
But it's made on a campfire, you know, in an old gallon tin can. So it has this kind of aura of being something.
The romance. Exactly.
The romance of the road.
Yeah. I think that's really funny. Was there a hobo named Mulligan who invented it?
There's lots of mythology about it, but who knows? I mean, they think that it's one of the foods which was developed by the Union Pacific Railroad gangs during the 19th century. It's one of the, you know, the workers were fed this kind of food.
Mm. So reading your book, and maybe, you know, my head is so into food in general, I get the sense that people, you know, talked about food and food policy in the mainstream, I guess, policy discussions a lot more back during this time than we were just talking about how we don't see the candidates right now talking enough about food policy. What do you guys think?
Well, they're certainly not talking about food policy at all in our current presidential campaign. And back then, food, the politics of food and handing out food and relief food was on, topic A for Congress and for the presidents back particularly during the 1930s. And huge debates were going on at the time, and there was lots. It was a very important issue,
and so was nutrition. This was really the beginning of a kind of mainstream knowledge of things like carbohydrates and proteins and calories and minerals and vitamins. Mm-hmm. This was knowledge that homemakers, women, suddenly felt they really had to have in order to wring the most nutrients out of the food and keep their kids from getting deficiency diseases.
Yeah.
So it was a time when people felt knowledge of nutrition was really critical to the health of their families.
And now knowledge of nutrition is critical, but it's for not starvation reasons, but obesity.
Now, exactly. We're trying.
But that's another form of malnutrition.
Right.
Because you're eating the wrong kinds of foods.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you wish that the candidates today or just in mainstream political discussion, we're talking about any certain issues that you find pressing nowadays that aren't being discussed?
Well, I think the issue of whether it's right or not to give people who don't have food and who are going hungry to give them food.
Yeah.
And we believe that, yes, they should be given food.
Mm-hmm.
And that's certainly not being discussed today. I mean, both candidates in our current election are essentially saying, well, that they're both going to improve the economy and that will sort of lift all boats and people will get fed that way. I believe Clinton has a little bit, is certainly taking the issue more seriously. The other candidate has not mentioned it at all.
Right, right.
Okay. But the Democratic party platform does mention food insecurity, definitely.
And that's super relevant right now. Do you think that the discussion of nutrition is being a little bit out of the limelight with the political discussion? I haven't seen too many talk about it right now. Certainly, the Obamas have done quite a bit of work in, you know, just public opinion and so forth and initiatives for children. But, yeah, I don't see too much of that going on right now in the campaign.
No, we're really sort of quiet on that topic, and it's really dangerous because people are hungry and people don't have access to all the good things that they should have, being that it's here, but the access isn't there.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of folks are saying, you know, we need to continue the work that the Obamas have started, and clearly from your book, a lot of other people have done a lot of progress in as well. So,
right. Well, our votes count, so go out there on Tuesday.
And I really think that this history gives a lot of inspiration and hopefully momentum to having those conversations more and more.
That would be great.
Yes, yes, we hope so.
All right. Well, I guess that's about all the time we have for today. But thank you so much for this really engaging book and discussion. And I hope many people have many discussions over their dinner tables about it soon. So thanks again, Jane.
Thank you so much.
Over the Thanksgiving table.
Over
that's a good
time. Over the Thanksgiving table. Well, you're helping out at the Bowery Mission, perhaps, at the food lines there. All right. Well, thanks again, Andrew and Jane. And thanks, everyone at Heritage. We'll see you next week on Eat Your Words.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.